Hi, thank you for listening to the Spotlight Report, our weekly podcast in which we sit down and speak with current academics about their life and research in lab. If you like the Spotlight Report, you can subscribe on iTunes, like our Facebook page, or find it on any common podcast app. You can also directly find the podcast on our website, which is loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast. Please comment any questions or ideas for people you would like us to interview in the future. Additionally, if you have more feedback, feel free to email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Hi, this week we're sitting down with Sam Nirenberg. He is a PhD student in the College of Optical Sciences studying quantum optics, and he gets into some very interesting, very theoretical and math-heavy topics. So, again, this is Logan Graves.
This is Shami.
And Sam, thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here, and I'm also happy that there's no video because my face is more built for audio. So
yeah, well, we can debate that. So first up, what made you go into optics?
That's actually an interesting story. I was homeschooled, and like a lot of homeschoolers now, instead of going to public school or private high school when the time came, and my parents kind of reached the limit of what they thought they could teach me, I went to community college. And I was very lucky to have an excellent community college near Toronto, New York, called Hudson Valley Community College. And they had really good programs in math and science. And I was originally going to be in fine art, but I had already audited some science classes through the local university. And I decided, what the heck, I'm going to take some math because just seems like a beautiful subject. And fun fact, I failed, despite the fact that I'd been teaching myself math as a homeschooler, I failed my first algebra quiz. Wow. And freaked out. And I found out they had a tutoring center. And so I went there and spent, I don't know, probably like 8 straight hours just trying to understand this algebra quiz that I just bombed. and at the end of that, you know, working through it and understanding the concepts, I found that the process of solving these problems and understanding that math was more like a language, I really found it beautiful. And so I worked hard at it, and over the period of the 4 years I was in community college, I ended up taking as many math and physics classes as I could there, and really realizing that what I loved was mathematical-based fields. Art is great as well, but this seemed to be my passion. And around the time I was a senior there, someone who is now my stepbrother talked to my mother, and he was going to the University of Rochester in optics. Mm-hmm. We were from the same town. And he said, well, hey, there's this degree I'm in called optics, which is based in physics. It's highly mathematical, and by the way, it happens to be one of the most highly paid and in-demand undergraduate degrees there is. And I thought to myself, math, money, what could be better than that? This is everything I've been looking for. So at the tender age of 14 and a half, 15, I guess it would have been like 15 and a half, I decided, well, there's only two schools in the country, well, more now, but at the time, only two schools in the country that really have undergraduate optics programs, University of Rochester and University of Arizona, and there's no way I'm staying in upstate New York. And as an avid rock climber at the time, I thought Arizona sounded great. So I came to visit University. I set my sights on that, came to visit University of Arizona, I want to say in 2008. And Dr. Mike gave me my first tour, and I'd already had my sights set on it. I didn't apply to any, I've never applied to any other school than University of Arizona, actually. So I applied, got in, and found myself in the world that we now inhabit.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
You and I did a similarly ballsy thing in that we both only applied here.
Really?
Which, you know, it works out, but if it doesn't, that would have been not a good idea.
Well, for a scholar of your caliber, it's probably a safe bet.
It's questionable, but one thing I do want to note, and I'm going to entirely derail from the outline that we set up for this interview.
Good.
Maybe we can get to
improv.
It. Yeah, perfect.
Yes, and?
Maybe we can get to it later, but at one point, I remember we were talking, and someone made the comment that they thought that math and physics and science isn't creative. It's not a creative field. And you made the same face that you made right now, which was it's a wave of disdain and disbelief.
Blank disbelief.
Right, and then falling in on yourself on where to start explaining that. But I don't know if I want to get into it just yet. Maybe we can get into it later on.
Yeah, sure. I'll have some time to organize
your
emotions.
Right. But it reminded me of it when you're talking about the fact that you started in with
metalsmithing.
Right. Doing artistic stuff, and then you transitioned this.
Yeah, and we can move on to that later if you like. One thing I will say though is that there is the illusion. Well, setting aside this spurious notion that there's no creativity. In fact, there's a huge amount. But I'm an experimental physicist. I work in a field that's very fundamental, and theorists do a lot of work in it. But I'm an experimental physicist, meaning I test the theories that the theorists come up with, and I make observations, and I try and make the physics physically happen. surprise, that's what happens. And there is a very, there's a set of skills you learn when you work with your hands in any field. And whether that's silversmithing or painting or experimental physics, you learn a vocabulary of techniques to make things work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those techniques and skills, they translate no matter what you do. Working with your hands and the joy you get from creating something physical, those are universal. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
No, I think that's beautifully put. So
thanks.
All right, so what made you decide then? You got here, and why did you decide not only to continue on and get a PhD, but more specifically to get a PhD in the field that you're in?
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting question. So the undergraduate degree here is rigorous and wonderful for optics, but I feel it's difficult, especially at the age of 18, to really know what field is going to completely capture your interest. And you may have noticed when I first started talking about how I got into optics, what really captured me was math, right? And I'm not a mathematician. I branched off from, you know, a field of being a true mathematician a long time ago. As physicists, we use math as a tool, but we do not necessarily do maths. So I went through the program, and I had developed a lot of skills and a good understanding of light and how to apply it, but for some reason I just wasn't as jazzed as I thought I was going to be about going to a company and working on engineering projects. Now, don't let me say there's anything wrong with engineering. There's nothing wrong with you guys.
Okay.
You're just nothing wrong.
You're human
beings. what I really realized was that there was something missing from something that made my study give my work meaning in the way that I wanted it to, right? That I wanted it to. A certain generation of us from Ops undergrads took classes with Professor Ewan Wright, and we were all extremely lucky, very lucky to do so. And my senior year, well, actually, I guess it would have been my second semester junior year, okay, because I started optics my freshman year due to my community college credits. I took his undergraduate optical physics class,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly I put the dust together of what I was missing, because I'd always enjoyed my more abstract classes. And I realized that what I really liked was the physics. Mm-hmm. The engineering was great and necessary, but what really got me going was just seeing how these beautiful mathematical models mapped to nature and could explain these esoteric and mysterious physical phenomena with no stated purpose other than understanding them was really great to me. And so I decided to myself, well, I also like lasers, and I still haven't given up the idea of making money entirely. So I said, well, lasers are a beautiful subject that I seem to have liked, and they're also lucrative. So I decided I was going to apply to the PhD program and study lasers, though I expected maybe only to finish a master's. I hadn't really chosen, but it gave me more options. And I wasn't actually accepted to the PhD program, one of the great tragedies of the 21st century.
Yeah.
But I was accepted as a master's student, and I thought, well, you know, let's see how far this goes. Because I guess I should back up. After my junior year, my senior year, I basically had no more undergraduate optics classes left to take, so I took these graduate classes and some gen eds, and I found that I also really liked the graduate classes, so I sort of checked my impulse and said, well, yeah, okay, so I seem to be able to handle the graduate work, and I like it. So now when I come and I apply to graduate school and get in for real, I had this sick notion that I was going to try in my first year just take the most abstract and painful load that I could find. Because I think many of us get into science for maybe at first somewhat masochistic reasons. I'd heard that one of the most challenging first-year classes was Brian Anderson's, Professor Brian Anderson, who's now my advisor, his first-year quantum class. So I decided to take that, and I met Brian. And I loved the class. And I would stay after class and sometimes ask Brian questions. And I think any of the professors that have mentored me know that I've at some point just been annoyed by my incessant question asking. But they've humored me, thankfully.
It's what they're paid for. You know?
I think they're paid to advance the knowledge of the human species. But maybe in part they're paid to humor Sam Nirenberg. And hopefully he will follow up on the tradition of advancing knowledge, but probably not. Anyway, but he eventually asked me, you know, well, what are you doing? And so I told him, and he seemed to think I had a talent for quantum mechanics, especially coming out of an engineering background, and eventually told me that if I worked hard and distinguished myself in my first year, he'd try and help me get into the PhD program. And I guess I did, and I did. And so I looked at a couple of different research groups for a while, but eventually came back to working for Brian. And I'm now in my fifth year, and I've been running one of his labs by myself for about 2 years now. So you were wondering why I got into this field. It was hard to know at first because, you know, even as a first-year graduate student or second year, it's really hard to know enough about the physics to really see the end goal. But what I love about my field is that it is for one thing, it's a beautiful example of quantum mechanics. Bose-Einstein condensation, macroscopic quantum behavior is somewhat esoteric, even though it's a broad area of study, and involves just so many different disciplines. You have to know about lasers. You have to know about electronics. You have to know about atomic physics. You have to know about vacuum systems. You have to know quantum mechanics. It provides a very powerful testbed for many other theories, as well as examining the properties of matter itself. And in addition to that, Bose-Einstein condensates behave extremely analogously to light. So while I've moved to atomic physics, in an area that many would consider to be somewhat separate from optics, I work in an area in part called atom optics, where you do things that you do in optics with atoms, which is weird, but hopefully we'll get into that.
So what is your research goal about that?
So my research goal, okay, the research goal of my group is to study two-dimensional quantum turbulence in Bose-Einstein condensates. Now, that sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But...
yes, it does. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But let's talk about what a Bose-Einstein condensate is briefly at first. I can go into more detail later if necessary.
I don't even think we need to talk about it because we can just point people to this movie that
this
I brought
movie?
Up the other day.
Oh, God. I know what you're going to say.
I'm blanking on the name of it, but I'm going to have to put up a link for it in the podcast.
Are you talking about Spectral?
That's Spectral. There you go.
Yeah, well, you know, the great thing about that movie is how very scientifically accurate it is.
Yeah.
The fact that I was about to say, you know, describe Bose-Einstein condensates in not much detail, but I think they do a great job there. Namely, that Bose-Einstein condensates are souls that we trap and manipulate for our own evil purposes. And we send them to unstable war zones, and they go rogue and take out large numbers of special operations units.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can tell from the tone of my voice, but I'm totally serious.
Yeah, it's a.
No, the movie made me cringe.
It's the reason I bring this up. You told me you look a little confused.
Yeah, totally confused about that. I feel like there is a war, and MSF is out of the world.
So let's bring it over to this side. The reason I bring it up, and part of what prompted, we've been wanting to talk to Sam for a while, but part of what prompted is that my parents saw Spectral and said, you know what, this is a hell of a movie. it's, you know, action, nonstop, Bose-Einstein condensates.
Oh, God.
I mean, you're tying action and science. It's great.
We're using science in the loosest.
Okay. Right. They took some creative liberties, but
yes.
But yeah, the premise is that Bose-Einstein condensates are souls that are used as war, something somewhat absurd. And I was like, I know the perfect person to respond to this.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well. So my response is that they're not. But the movie is very imaginative. I guess I could leave it at that.
So what do you really do?
Okay, so what I really do is I use lasers and magnetic fields and radio frequency of light to trap and cool gas clouds, basically, of specific atoms. We all know that atoms have discrete resonances. They have an energy level structure where they can absorb and re-emit frequencies of light. And light carries momentum, and atoms are very small. So to briefly talk about it, we choose a specific type of atom. Okay, this atom has certain properties which allow us to make a Bose-Einstein condensate. The main property of them is that all of their constituent particles have a quantum spin. And the sum of the quantum spin of all their particles adds up to an integer multiple or an integer number. And this means the particle is a boson as opposed to a fermion, like an electron would be. A photon is an example of a boson. But the atom as a whole system has bosonic behavior. And this allows us to get them, all into a single quantum state. The Pauli exclusion principle does not apply to bosons. The second thing that's very important about them is that it's a member of the alkali metal group in the periodic elements, which means it has a hydrogen-like valence structure, which means that its energy level structure is relatively simple and amenable to laser cooling. What this means is that we can find groups of energy levels which are well separated. And so we can have photons be absorbed somewhere in the energy level structure. And when they re-emit, they'll fall back into the same state they started out at, which is nice because it means we can keep using the same wavelength of light to cool them. We go through an initial cooling phase. We create this cloud of rubidium atoms in a vacuum chamber, and we use a combination of magnetic fields and lasers to cool it. It's called a magneto-optical trap. If someone would like to read it, there's a great paper on the modern sort of configuration of magneto-optical trap by E.L. Raab. That's R-A-A-B.
We'll put a link to it too.
Okay, sounds good. This allows us to cool a cloud of a few billion atoms down to about 100 microkelvin. That's 100 millionths of a degree above absolute zero, which is pretty darn cold. But it's still not cold enough to form a Bose-Einstein condensate. So what we do is we transfer that atom using magnetic fields into an even lower pressure vacuum chamber, several orders of magnitude lower than outer space. We do this because we don't want background collisions with atoms because that causes heating. Mm-hmm. And these are very delicate states of matter. So we have our couple billion atoms suspended in a magnetic field. And this part's a little hard to explain without some acquaintance with quantum, but there's something called a Zeeman shift, which means that energies of atoms change depending on the magnetic fields that that they're exposed to, the strength of the magnetic field. And so hotter atoms, right, in a confined magnetic field, hotter atoms have more energy. They tend to be able to move farther out to the edges, right, because they can overcome the force pulling them back to the center more than the colder atoms can. So what we want to do is we want to evaporate the hotter atoms so that the ensemble as a whole comes down to a lower temperature. Mm-hmm. So since they spend more time at the higher magnetic field because they're farther away from the center, they have a transition frequency for the change in their magnetic moment, right? Their atoms are little magnets, which is why we can trap them magnetically. So that happened. That the frequency we need to drive them with to flip their magnetic moment to be untrappable by the magnetic field, think like north-south pole, they repel each other, right? Happens to be in the radio frequency. So we shine radio frequency light on these atoms, okay? And the ones that have the right transition frequency, which depends on their position from the center, which depends mm-hmm. on their temperature, flips them and they get kicked out. So what we do is we sweep our frequency from high to low, okay? And this literally acts like a knife cutting out the atoms at the edges because the farther out they are, you know, they have a different transition frequency because the magnetic field is different. And it flips the hotter atoms, their magnetic moments, so they all get kicked out. And we repeat this until we're left with a group of atoms which have a low enough energy that they what happens is they go through a stimulated scattering process. They sort of collide with each other and distribute their energy across each other, and it brings the whole ensemble down to a temperature where they all collapse to the same quantum state of the magnetic trap, right? A magnetic trap provides different states that the atoms can be in relative to it. And all these atoms collapse into the same one, which is the ground state. They don't have enough energy to leave the ground state. All these atoms. So they all collapse, and since they're bosons, they can all occupy it. Mm-hmm. And what this means is that, and I'm going to use a technical term here, they all enter the same single particle wave function. Mm-hmm. So we have about 2 million atoms, which all are in the same quantum state. Statistically, normally, if you have some temperature, right, the occupation of a specific state is low compared to the number of total atoms. But in this case, it's a large fraction,
right,
a macroscopic fraction.
Right.
Okay, and the way and there's a few ways to think about this. One is, you know, they fall into the same quantum state, and they all have this. They're all described by a single wave function. Okay, so you can sort of think of this as you can actually very directly think of this as photons in a laser cavity. Mm-hmm. They're all in the same through stimulated emission, you know, sort of like the stimulated scattering process. They're all in the same frequency, same quantum state, and they have coherence with each other. And we can describe mm-hmm. all those photons, right, by a single electric field.
Right.
So a spatially dependent electric field with a spatially dependent phase. Same thing with our atoms. And the real mind-blowing kicker is this. We know that, due to de Broglie, that matter acts like a wave. But we say, well, why don't we see matter acting like waves, like interfering?
Right.
The reason is the following. The wave-like nature is proportional to the momentum, okay, which is proportional to the mass. or inversely proportional. And it just so happens that the at room temperatures or anything like, you know, any normal conceivable temperature, the wave-like nature of the atom is evident on a scale much smaller than the Coulomb interaction. So they bounce off each other due to Coulomb interactions well before they can interact like waves, mm-hmm. right? We know that the de Broglie wavelength is proportional to momentum, which can be related to temperature, inversely proportional. So as we cool them down, their wave-like nature becomes more and more evident on larger and larger scales. Once we get to a certain point where the wave-like nature exists on a scale larger than the average, interatomic distance, then they can start to interact.
Right.
So when we get to a state of this group of atoms, which is very purely BEC, generally the de Broglie wavelength, okay, when it's 10 to the minus 9th, 10 times 10 to the minus 9th degrees above absolute zero, the de Broglie wavelength is generally on a scale larger than the entire volume of trapped atoms.
Okay.
So now you have matter. You have matter acting like a wave, like photons act like a wave.
Right.
And like you put photons on top of each other, they don't bounce off each other. You get a higher density of photons.
Right.
Here, you can't really think of the atoms as having an individual identity so much anymore. You think of a bunch of waves adding together, and because of the process by which the simulated scattering process by which they've entered this state, they add constructively. So now, instead of having a bunch of individual atoms, you have a sort of blob of
like
atom density.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an atom density.
Okay.
Right. So you have an atom density field, like an electric field is a photon mm-hmm. density field. Okay. I want to be careful about this because people listen to this. I don't want to get too weird. But you describe all of the atoms with a single spatially dependent density and spatially dependent phase, like you describe a system of photons with a spatially dependent electric field and a spatially dependent phase.
Right.
Spatial amplitude, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so that's a BEC.
Okay.
Okay. So the thing to remember that is this is still a cloud. This is still a fluid, like air is a fluid. However, because it's so low energy, it's what's called a superfluid. And a superfluid has zero friction. I mean, not low friction, zero friction. Okay? And so what this means is if I could isolate the system very, very well from its environment, and I were to create a circular flow in it, right? Mm-hmm. Then, if I could isolate it well enough, you know, an absence, that flow would persist.
Right.
Could, you know, in some sense, perpetually. So, this is something that was studied, in liquid helium, I want to say back in the 60s. It might be earlier than that. So these persistent currents, were studied by people like Lev Landau, these people, and they came up with these theories. And people wanted a better way of understanding superfluidity and characterizing it. And people became very interested in the relation between normal fluid motion and the fluid motion of these quantum fluids. And so what we do is we specifically study quantum fluid motion. And we try and relate it back to problems in classical fluid motion or draw analogy to classical fluid motion. Now, you can imagine that in three dimensions, studying things like vortices is very difficult. Okay, I'll give you some example of vortices that people maybe don't think of in nature, that people maybe don't think of all the time as vortices. Smoke rings, okay? Mm-hmm. Or when you are paddling a canoe and you stir an oar through water, you see two whirlpools, right? Those are vortices. But in fact, there's a line going underneath the surface that connects those two. They're connected by this line of vorticity.
Right.
Okay, so it's half a smoke ring. So now in 3D, you see that you have to contend with these lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have something like a disordered group of vortices, you get things like their lines tangle inside the fluid, and maybe you'd image those things doing something like some sort of tomography.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it becomes very hard to distinguish between the vortices, and track their motion and understand the ball motion of the fluid. So what we do is when we have this 3D little blob of quantum fluid atom vapor, we come in with a laser, and you can exert forces on atoms with lasers without photons being absorbed and adding energy by detuning them from quantum resonances. If they're red detuned, atoms will move towards high intensity. If they're blue and detuned, they'll move away from high intensity. So it's this push-pull effect due to the AC Stark effect. So we shine a sheet of highly focused red detuned light, so it's focused astigmatically. Mm-hmm. And this, in one dimension, flattens our BEC. So we flatten it to a point where the fluid motion is confined to two dimensions, so we don't have to contend with these vortex lines.
Right.
And so we can just look at vortex interaction.
In
2D. Yeah, and I've gotten ahead of myself. There's probably some clarifying questions we can talk about in that. But the idea is this. This is what 2D quantum turbulence in the Bose-Einstein condensate means. We have a quantum fluid suspended in a magnetic field in a vacuum chamber, and we use lasers to both flatten it until the fluid motion is confined to two dimensions and disturb it in order to induce the fluid motion.
So I have two questions that pop up. One is these BECs are acting like they are a fluid.
Yes.
But a frictionless fluid.
Yes.
And you're relating phenomena that you can observe in those to more classical fluid phenomenon.
Yes.
To what purpose? I mean, it's so hard. We might get into the details, but it's so hard to make a BEC.
Tell me about it.
Right. You know, I mean, I sat in on Zach Newman's defense.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was awesome.
He's a great presenter and a really good scientist.
It was awesome. I mean, his dissertation was in no small part building the machine to make the BECs.
Yeah, he built our second BEC machine.
Right. And it's a huge
endeavor. Jessica Myers.
Yeah.
Jessica Myers.
So it's a huge endeavor, but I mean, why? Why is it so much more beneficial to be able to observe this phenomenon in a frictionless fluid?
Interesting. So, okay. Well, first of all, it's probably good to say that specifically turbulence is not well understood anywhere in nature. Mm-hmm. So we'll start by saying that. But there's a few things that might make it advantageous in quantum fluids. Another foreshadowing thing is that quantum turbulence is still, 2D quantum turbulence is still not well defined. A large part of our research in my group is to facilitate a rigorous definition and understanding of what it means to have 2D quantum turbulence and characterize it. There are signatures similar to classic turbulence, for instance, transport of energy across length scales that follows a power law, k to the minus 5/3. And simulations have shown evidence of that in quantum terms as well. But it becomes dicey, and I don't want to get into that too much because I'll probably put my foot in my mouth. But here's why it's nice to study in quantum fluids. In classical fluids, so if you have fluid motion, you can break down any vector field into a rotational and irrotational part, okay? Mm-hmm. And in turbulence, one of the most conspicuous aspects of turbulence is the development of vorticity, these vortices, this circular motion mm-hmm. of the fluid, and the self-similar decay of these vortices into other vortices. When you stir with a paddle, you see the big vortices, they break into smaller and smaller and smaller ones. In 2D turbulence, actually the reverse happens, which is something I'm studying, but we can get into that later. But when you try and understand the transport of energy momentum through the system and the fluid motion, it becomes difficult in classical fluids because the vorticity is continuous. It can circulate with any amount of energy in these structures, and there's no real good quantitative way of measuring it. I mean, how can you do that? You put colored smoke in air or something, but there's not really a good way of quantifying, you know, this transport of things like energy, momentum through the fluid and through these structures. Now, all that is nicely solved by quantum mechanics because it is quantized, right? Meaning that it can only be delivered in discrete and transferred in discrete packets. Furthermore, and also in BECs, in these quantum fluids, circular motion can only be supported through quantized vorticity. So here's how we want to think about it, okay? In a BEC, the vortices are very conspicuous indicators of circular motion. And you may say, why? Well, let's go back to something a little mathematical. You can describe the velocity of this quantum fluid, the BEC, as being proportional to the derivative of the phase. Okay, and the integral around a loop of the velocity is, you know, proportional to circulation, is proportional to vorticity, and it's quantized. It has to be in units of pi. It has to be in multiples of pi. Okay.
Right.
So when we have this circular motion, okay. We have this sort of change of the phase by 2 pi around, by a multiple of 2 pi around a circle, okay? And so as we go closer to the center, it still has to go through a 2 pi winding, but it has to do it faster now.
Right.
So the derivative of the phase gets larger, and so the velocity gets larger. Mm-hmm. And as we go closer to the center, it has to go through a 2 pi loop faster and faster until the center, you know, it blows up.
Right.
There's a discontinuity. And so how do we conserve energy? How do we make sure there's not, you know, an infinite velocity, infinite kinetic energy there? Well, nature knows what to do. The phase is undefined, and that area is evacuated. There are no atoms there. So when you have a vortex, there is necessarily a hole through the center of the BEC. And so when we shine light on top of it, which is generally how we image it through several absorption or phase shifts, absorption is the easiest way. We look at the shadow. Then these holes become very conspicuous. I mean, they're small, but we can image them. And so it's very easy to see a vortex. And when we see a vortex, well, it's quantized.
Right.
We know how much energy is in that. And we know the velocity field due to each vortex, right? And they're not linear. But when we see an arrangement of vortices, well, then we can back out what the velocity field of the bulk fluid is.
Huh.
And so they form a very conspicuous and pleasant way of coming up with quantitative models for fluid motion.
Huh. Okay.
So that's why it's nice to study fluid motion in a quantum fluid. It's counterintuitively, it's somewhat easier.
Right. Definitely counterintuitively, but but it sounds like you can arrive at a more observable, definable phenomenon, which allows you to build theorems.
Yeah, to my knowledge. You know, I don't have the same knowledge of the literature that, you know, a professor might. But as far as I know, and justifying my own research to myself and my family, this is what I tell them. Yeah.
So what exactly, I mean, without that small hole you want to observe, is there anything you want to observe during the experiment?
Oh, I was just saying what we wanted to observe. Okay, so basically, what do we try to observe? So the holy grail of this is so I kind of hinted at before. What we're really doing right now is building a toolkit, an experimental toolkit for people to study turbulence and understand turbulence in quantum fluids. Like this is sort of a new and not totally fleshed out field, and so. We're trying to find the fundamental measurements that allow us to study this phenomenon. And so the holy grail really is to be able to take a video in real time of a distribution of vortices moving and changing. Mm-hmm. But I've already talked about how BECs are so low energy, you know,
right.
10 to the minus 10. As soon as you start adding photons and imaging things and having things be absorbed, you destroy it. One of the previous graduate students who worked in my lab, Kaylee Wilson, spent years working on methods to image with as little destruction as possible. And we were able to get, I believe, up to 8 frames separated by some amount of time, which is good. It was great work, but we still want to have something more continuous.
Right.
And so, because turbulence is a chaotic process, you know, we can't say that each run will be identical. So we can try and do things like, have the same experimental parameters, run it, take an image at a certain point, do that a few times, build up statistics, wait a little bit longer, and try and build up statistics about their motion. What it comes down to is a chaotic system.
Right.
And observing it in real time would really be what we want.
That's the Holy Grail.
Yeah, and
that's what Monty Python meant.
Yeah, like, yeah. The search of the Holy Grail.
Right.
Yeah, so... So that would be something we'd like to observe, and there are some ideas, but you know whether or not they're doable in a single PhD is not sure. But I think because what I've ended up doing in the last year or so is I've ended up creating a BEC in a different quantum state than we had before. The ground state of rubidium-87 actually has two total angular momentum substates. One is F equals 1, one is F equals 2. Since I've been traveling them in F equals 2 state, we think there may be some transitions available to us that allow us to do a cycling transition on a closed set of energy states that we can keep get a phase shift from the BEC with minimal exchange of momentum. So we're hoping that maybe that will be something we might be able to do in the future. The other things we'd like to observe is one of the things I'm working on is how to generate repeatable initial conditions. So we've talked about vortices, but not really how we form them. So one of the original ways to create vortices in a BEC was to, you know, it's usually in this circularly symmetric trap. One way was to tighten one side so it becomes like an oval, and then spin it really fast, and then let it go. And then that circular motion becomes distributed into vortices.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not really a local way of doing it.
Right.
Work that was done here by Tyler and Neely was to take a blue detuned beam and stir the BEC like an ore, and they could generate vortex dipoles.
Mm-hmm.
So it would generate oppositely circulating vortices. That was also a good method, but it also wasn't really localized. Carlos Sampson did work in doing something similar, but then it was actually two beams and splitting them, and each vortex would become pinned to a controlling beam, and by moving the beams, you could move the vortices and place them. But that becomes unfeasible because the amount of optical subsystems you need for more than two vortices is very large, and you need a ton of bench space. We're thinking about maybe at some point doing this with spatial light modulators to compact that.
Yeah.
And two vortices is not, it's a two-body problem. It's not a chaotic turbulent problem.
Right.
So, other methods were poking and all the stuff, and we're still working on those. But what looks promising, for me at least, is this method of generating vortices by using magnetic fields. Using linear magnetic fields to imprint a geometric face onto a BEC. So basically we talked about how, you know, the phase profile of a vortex is this 2π winding. Okay, and if you go – or this – 2π winding, multiple 2π winding. And you know, if it goes through a higher multiple of 2π, it's a higher charge vortex, and those vortices split into smaller singly charged vortices. But there's a way using linear magnetic fields that instead of, you know, trying to stir or do this, you can actually directly imprint that phase onto the BEC by creating a rotation of their spin vector, right? So they have some magnetic spin that follows the magnetic field, and by dipping the magnetic field through the BEC, you can think of every point sort of having an embedded spherical space where there's a vector in there that points in the direction of the spin.
Mm-hmm.
And by rotating it through that space, by changing the magnetic field, you pick up a phase shift just by the rotation through that space. That phase shift depends on the path through that space. It's called a Barry's phase, after Dr. Sir Michael Barry. Sir Dr. Michael Barry. I never know the order. Anyway, so by doing this, we can directly imprint the phase profile we want to generate a vortex on it. And this is a very local thing, right? Because wherever the zero magnetic field passes through, that's where the vortex is going to be centered around. My current project is to study that system, to study that process, and figure out how, if we can use it to repeatedly generate arbitrary configurations of vortices, and then eventually use it to study the clustering physics of vortices. Do you want to talk a little about that?
I do, but I think for the sake of time that we should probably transition.
Okay, let me say one thing, which is that by looking at large numbers of oppositely charged vortices, due to the two-dimensional physics, instead of breaking smaller length scales, bring down, or larger length scales, bring down the smaller ones cluster. So you have clusters of large clusters of similarly charged vortices. And so you have this sort of disordered order, which would seem like it would violate the second law of thermodynamics by, you know, entropy going the wrong direction. But in fact, we call it a negative effective temperature. So what we want to demonstrate with this is demonstrating a negative effective temperature for a vortex distribution. And that's an idea due to Lars Onsager. Anyway, that's the purpose of my research currently. In a nutshell.
All right, so the first question I want to ask is that I know how not easy this is and how tedious it is. So do you have any key experiences that stand out to you when you were just like, this is really challenging? And if you do, how did you get past it? What was your...
Yeah, so I think one of the things that when you're going through school that they don't really teach you about physics is that learning physics is not the same as doing physics.
Right.
In that when you learn physics, you're expected to figure it out and just succeed on a timeline. And doing physics has a lot more with failing a lot. You will fail more than you will succeed. And at first, this can be very frustrating. And the idea is to fail forward, to learn from each mistake and try new things. And so when you get stuck and things are very challenging, sometimes maybe a strategy is to like take a deep breath, step back, say, okay, like, you know, this isn't the be all and end all of my life. I just need to get through this one part, and this is challenging. Take a step back, take a deep breath, and carry on after you've calmed down a little bit. But the other thing is to maybe sometimes just really think of the wildest thing you can.
Yeah.
Like what could – it might be a long shot. But what is just something you just were never thinking about beforehand that could really just be holding you back? A good example is here's an interesting example. Not necessarily of that, but just just sort of ways I was being held back, and then we kind of figured out. I was creating BECs, and I noticed suddenly that once I got down to a certain magnetic field, then my cloud was splitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is this? Is this imaging? Like, what's the problem? And I worked for just such a long time on trying to fix my imaging system.
Mm-hmm.
It must be something wrong. It must be an aberration. There must be some problem with my beam. And then I was working with a graduate student at the time, and we started talking about it. And we were like, well, what's the fundamental thing that we're missing here? Like, what is the behavior of the system? The system is really the atoms. It's like, what would cause the atoms to split due to a high magnetic field? Well, if they have different magnetic moments, like F equals 1, F equals 2, they experience different forces. It becomes evident at high magnetic fields.
And they split.
They'll change. Yeah. And so once we realized that, then we said, hey, maybe we have this species of atom that we haven't really been able to get before. Maybe this is appearing now. You know, so really just kind of like thinking through what are the fundamental things that govern the behavior of my system.
Right.
And then if none of that happens, what's just the craziest thing I can think of? Why not?
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's really accurate. I think it happens. It happens or has happened to me a bunch too, where you get so absorbed in these complex research topics.
Yeah.
And you basically are, you know, 100 miles down into some very specific subset of your research.
Yeah.
And something goes wrong, and you try to explain it in this subset, and then depending on how wise you are, it might take a little bit longer, but eventually you get back to the basics and you get
usually the problems are fundamental, right?
Right. It's usually like overarching fundamentally what am I doing and what's going on. Yeah. So.
And if I'd say one last thing is that the worst thing you can do is make it about yourself. To internalize that failure as being due to you.
Yeah.
Science is failing until you get it right, and this process of exploration really is what doing science is. It's exploration. And so you can't take it personally.
Right, right.
When things don't work.
I'll tell myself that next time.
Or just send me a text. It's not you, Logan. It's not you. It's nature, Logan. It's not you.
It's science, you know?
It's science. Darn you, science.
So I would like to close out then with a discussion which might throw a lot of our listeners for a complete loop, and we could just permanently lose them, which is bridging into the creative side of science. Oh. And I think... this is a really interesting topic.
No, I like this. I like this.
I'll state something that's been on my mind for quite some time, which is that I started listening and reading some other people whose fields are entirely somewhat.
What?
So I know, right? Don't tell my advisor. But they're unrelated to science, but their drive is that they're taking literature or religious texts or folk tales or mythology, and they're just trying to understand where does it come from, how do you have this imprinted human knowledge pass on, etc. But the base description, the base goal of it is that you're trying to explore and understand things. And these are people who are in literature fields, or there are people who do art and they're explaining how the art, I mean, you're an artist, so sorry to put you on the spot.
What's your medium?
Medium?
What do you work with?
Paint.
Oh, wow.
Draw stuff, or cut stuff and stick it up together.
Oh, that's
like
cool.
That.
So it's sort of like collage and multimedia.
It's
that's
cool
awesome.
Stuff, dude.
I'd love to see it. My girlfriend's a painter as well.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
Great.
Yeah.
But there,
I'll
but
see you sometime.
It's okay. It's this drive to express something.
Okay.
And I personally feel that a lot in the sciences. But I'm curious what's your response?
Well, I mean, I think the expression is a good idea. I mean, so people who are strict scientists, please don't judge me for the philosophical rabbit hole I'm about to go down. I'm a dilettante in philosophy. So, so I think expression is a good idea. I think fundamentally, right, the idea is that art is trying to express something that is very difficult to do physically, right? Mm-hmm. It's difficult to do in, say, visual art is difficult to do in writing. This is the idea behind the whole movement of modernism, right? Clement Greenberg and his ideas of medium specificity, coupled with the writings of Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst, and once painters accepted medium specificity, the idea that they shouldn't try and emulate other things, work within the constraints of painting, 2D, color, whatever, and they shouldn't try and emulate sculpture, they said, well, what are we going to express?
Right.
And the idea was they were going to express their subconscious symbolically, like Carl Jung had. So these people like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, they were really doing their therapy through their art. And so they came up with these ideas of gestural painting or color field and these things to express something that was subconscious and not readily accessible through normal scientific methods. Like, it's not a broken arm. It's not.
Right.
So these, they were trying to express something unique and difficult about the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Art is a form of expression. Science, in some ways, we have it easier because nature works according to a set of logic.
And nature just works.
Nature works.
Nature was there before we were here, and it'll be here after we're here.
It's the craziest thing. And we haven't discovered necessarily how that code of logic applies to things like human emotions and thoughts, but we are using a language of mathematics and methodologies of experiment, and philosophers may disagree that we actually have methodologies, but they're smoking pipes.
Right,
on
right.
But we're trying to express ideas about nature, and we do it very directly.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I want to get into: the idea that it's not creative is nonsense. I think people think that the reason it's not creative is that there are rules. There are these logical rules, and they say, well, if you have rules, it stifles creativity.
Right.
But art is not without rules. You have color theory. There's flexibility within a framework, which is what science is. You're trying to work within a framework to express things.
Right.
And in order to capture an experiment or to capture a model that captures nature, you have to use the framework of mathematics and technology in order to do that in a way that's elegant,
mm-hmm.
compact, correct.
Yeah.
And in art, you have to work within some framework of color theory, geometries, the constraints of your medium,
mm-hmm.
music too. I mean, there are ways of seemingly bending these rules, but they're still within reference to them. I mean, Ornette Coleman versus Bach.
Yeah.
They're working inside the same structure. They just use it in different ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody understands the way Ornette Coleman. why does it work? I don't know if it does.
No, I think that's a really, really beautiful way to put it, too. I think I was having a conversation with my other friend who's a nuclear physicist. I have to get less nerdy friends.
We should go to a jazz club or something.
Yeah, right? I was about to talk about jazz.
I've been meaning to start smoking cigarettes. So.
Only if you roll them yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But he's really into these texts, and his recent statement of his that I agree with is that fundamentally it's part of the human condition is really about storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be expressing things that are inexpressible through the medium of language, through art, whatever that medium might be. Or I think that scientists do it all the time, in that you see some phenomenon and you develop a means of telling the story.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good and a bad thing, in the sense that it's a really good thing to take that drive, that inner human emotion, and that drive, and honestly, creatively, find something and figure out how the hell am I going to explain it,
yeah.
and then explain it, and it happens to be in a very repeatable way.
Yes.
But it's not too dissimilar from the fact that, like, ancient humans found some phenomenon and made a story to explain it, just
sure.
in an irrepeatable way.
And just because Harry Potter can produce a Patronus every time doesn't make it not magic.
Exactly.
Yeah. People get a tendency to see, like, if there is something exists, or if this is something the nature should work in this way, then it's not creative because this is something exists.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but for them, it's like considering like they have to express something, and they feel like, okay, this is creative. This is my own idea, but they always ignore like why these things exist. Behind
yes.
that, you got a reason, you got some facts, you got some experiments result to support that, and that is something like not exist before, and is now somebody to discover them.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, I don't think it's possible to express something without a framework in order to do so.
Yeah.
I think the idea that it can be expressed is the beautiful thing, that there
yeah.
is a framework by which we can understand and create things. And that applies to art and science.
Right.
And when it comes down to it, they're both processes of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And being the first person, being the first person to, do a gestural painting that is meant to automatically express your subconscious, and having that thought that fits into the theory of art.
Right.
I mean, what's different between that and being the first person to, derive the oscillation between energy levels of an atom under an electric field? They saw that.
Right.
They saw that. They saw the path to doing that. They saw the significance of it, and they used their knowledge of the framework to express it in a way that, to varying extents of our expertise, we can all understand and relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all right. I think that's a good spot to close.
Thanks, guys. Yeah. This was really fun, and it got me out of the lab for a little bit.
As always, thank you for listening to this week's episode. We look forward to any comments or feedback you may have. To leave a comment, please visit our website at loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast or our Facebook, which is SPL Report. Additionally, you can email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Lastly, we would like to mention that we are always looking for new topics or people to interview. So if you have a topic that you would like us to cover, please let us know. Thank you and have a good week.